You're listening to Strong Asian Lead, the podcast for Asian Americans in film, television, and streaming. In this podcast, we hold candid discussions about the business and artistic side of Hollywood through the Asian American perspective and interview the trailblazing pioneers who made the industry what it is today. I'm your host, Masami Moria. This week, we sat down with Genevieve Kang, an actor on the Netflix series Lock and Key. We talked about her life as an actor and from Canada, her perseverance through illness, and what she would be doing if she wasn't acting. We also did a second part of this episode to ask questions about being mixed Asian, which we just wrapped into this one episode. But before we get into today's interview, I'd like to use this opportunity to ask you to support Strong Asian Lead. How can you support? Yeah, well, thanks for asking. There are plenty of ways to support us. And let me see. How can you support us? Well, thanks for asking. There are plenty of ways to support. There's the obvious method of donating to our crowdfund, PayPal, or even Venmo, all of which can be found on our show notes or our website. You can even do it right now and search for @StrongAsianLead on Venmo, or skip the fees and help us out by donating straight to Mas Moria, MasMoriya. But if you're unable to donate, totally cool. Like, I totally understand. I get asked to donate for things all the time, and money's hard to come by sometimes. Money can, you know, rent's high, gas is high, everything's high, inflation's crazy, and can't always donate. So I totally understand. We're all in different positions and, you know, can't always do money. So if you can't donate, please join us at one of our meetups. We do ask for donations there too. But primarily, we're based in Los Angeles, but we want to go to other areas and other big cities. I really miss New York, so I want to get back out there more often. The more people we have at our meetups, the better opportunities we have to get sponsorships, to help us pay for venues, snacks, and drinks, and to go out to other cities, and so we can grow Strong Asian Lead. And if you're unable to make the meetup, whether you're in a different city, you're busy that day, or you know, just you don't want to come from the west side to Little Tokyo, which is where we usually have it, you can also share this podcast or with a friend, or just post one thing on your Instagram or any social media. We post Instagram reels and audiograms from this podcast so that other people can share things. And we post things pretty frequently enough that you can just share stuff out. And if it's helpful to you, maybe it's helpful to somebody else. Like, we just, please share something, tell somebody, refer us to your friends. You know, you don't have to refer our services or anything, but you can refer us just as a resource. And we have plenty of that. If you know a lot about us, we have free resources everywhere. And if you don't know about those resources, members.strongasianlead.com is where you can sign up and you can get all the resources there. You have to make a profile, but you get all the links and all the stuff. Or if you have the weekly emails, all the links at the bottom are the resources. And a lot of times, like 90% of them, you can do it without the profile. Just go click on them. But we encourage you to make a profile so you can meet other fellow Asians and there's other resources you can have. And to then tell your friends to go make a profile too. But overall, share something. It's really not all that hard to share a post. And I know even sometimes I can't share everything, but I try to share as much as I can, you know, just a story. People follow your stories, you know, and just see things. If you just post our Instagram, our logo, or Instagram, you know, our podcast, anything, it helps us and it costs you nothing. So it would be really helpful. And if you're not on social media, there's a few people who aren't, or they're not active, so I understand. Or maybe you just don't want to share on your public platform for whatever reason. Just let other people know about us by word of mouth. I mean, that's really helpful too. I often talk to strangers and tell them what I do, and they're surprised because they're all like, I already follow Strong Asian Lead. Whoa, that's really cool. I even had my mom tell me that when she was in Boston that she was talking to a woman and her brother was already following us. And so, you know, she told him, like, reach out. And he hasn't reached out. But, you know, I think it's cool to hear that other people really do follow us. Excuse me. And it's humbling. It's nice to know that other people are following and use the work. And so as much as we're not, like, a big 100,000 followers, that we don't have a big fund for marketing, we don't have a lot of stuff, we still do a lot of things. And to see that people are using the resource and at least following and know about us to keep us growing is really nice, and it is really helpful. I think we're just about to break 4,500 followers on Instagram, and I know that's, for some people, that's not a lot. for us, it's like, okay, that's nice. It's a really good milestone. But I hope that more people would follow us and more people would just know about us, because I think we're, even me, as humble as generally as I am, and I try to talk myself up or anything that we do, but in general, I do think Strong Asian Lead as a secondary thought is really helpful to everybody. I just happen to be the person who does a lot of the work. But if I had, you know, other things, if I wasn't doing this, I think it would be really helpful to me too. So I hope that's helpful to you, and I hope that you will share with other people so that's helpful to them, and it keeps growing, and we could all have a great time, and we all don't feel seen in the industry, and that we get to work together in the future. And I hope to meet all of you at some point. And yeah, you know, you can always say hi to me. I'm usually not an asshole. I might be tired. I might be very, very tired. But I like to meet everybody. And as long as you're not a jerk to me, I won't be a jerk to you. That's kind of the rule for life, right? So either way, what we're asking is for your support. No matter what you do, we're asking for your support. We want to grow Strong Asian Lead to be something that is both as an invaluable resource for the community and a healthy nonprofit, so that we can sustain our growth without having to take out personal debt, which is what I've had to do. We like to make this our full-time single job instead of having 3 or 4 jobs to pay our personal bills and pay for the things that we need to continue to work. A lot of the stuff that we got to pay for comes out of my own pocket. We're out of crowdfunding money. We don't have that anymore. So all the stuff that's on the website, that's got to be paid for. Our Calendly, our Zooms, Adobe, you know, all of that comes out of my own pocket. And I don't really have a lot of money, but you know, at the same time, we can't really stop Strong Asian Lead at this point. And that's kind of the tough part. Like, if we can't stop Strong Asian Lead, but we don't really have the money to keep going, as it's just coming out of my own pocket. So please, you know, I am begging just a little bit, to help me help Strong Asian Lead. If you don't want to help me personally for whatever reason, but help Strong Asian Lead, help the community. If you're really about Asian American representation or Asian American conversations in Hollywood, you know, and you think this is helpful, if you're listening to this podcast, if you listen to me talk for 5 minutes about supporting this, we'd really appreciate that help. And I think that's, you know, it's something you can give back. I hope that you would do that, but I can't force you. So either way, you can just listen to this podcast and take it for free. And that's totally great too. I would just ask you to please share somehow, whether it's just word of mouth or just telling people, or, you know, just hype it up a little bit. Talk to other people. Word of mouth is just as great support as anything else too. So any way you support is really grateful. And thank you. That's all I can really say. And so, oh, that's it. So, again, I'll transition back into talking about Genevieve Kang. Genevieve was super sweet. I really appreciated her time and them reaching out. We did have to have a follow-up second episode, so I have to do some extra editing, but you know what? I hope Genevieve is doing well. I haven't talked in about a year. And I just really appreciated her time and hearing her story. And we hope that what she has to say is helpful to you. So, here's our interview with Genevieve Kang. Well, Genevieve, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. My name is Genevieve Kang, and I'm currently living in Vancouver, British Columbia, and my hometown is a smaller city in the interior of BC known as Kamloops.
Kamloops, right?
Kamloops, yeah.
I saw that name today. I was like, okay, how do I say that? Yeah. It's a new one for me, right on. Well, how's your week been going? You've been busy working on other shows, or just kind of like in between shows right now?
I'm in between gigs right now. So it's mostly, I'm just mostly at home. I'm working actually on a script of my own right now. And then otherwise, I recently adopted a rescue pup from Shanghai. So it's been also busy just acclimatizing and getting him adjusted to life in Canada, and then also just me getting used to being a new dog mom. So
that's so great. Yeah, I feel like nice having a pet right now. And yeah, you adopted from Shanghai. Did they ship the dog over, or
Yeah. So it kind of came as a surprise to me. I've been keeping my eye out to adopt a rescue for a while. And a friend of mine, actually, she kept on sending me postings for this one dog, and he's a lab mix. And that just wasn't the breed I envisioned myself with. He's my first dog. And I'm very much, I love anything like husky, anything that looks like a wolf. I'm just like, that's my dog. But so I wasn't really keen on just his appearance when she kept on sending me this listing for this dog who was looking for a home. And weeks went by and she resent me the post. And she's like, he's still available. You should check it out. And so I logged on and I saw, basically I saw this video and some photos and heard his story. And yeah, as soon as I saw his face, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is my dog. And yeah, it just felt very much aligned. And so I reached out to the organization and that deals with the rescues there. So it's Rescue Paws Canada, shout out. Yeah, with it, like the day I submitted my application, a few hours later, I was being interviewed. And then on the spot, the adoption coordinator was just like, we think you'd be with this dog. And so within a few days, he was already being planned to arrive in Vancouver. So they were also trying to rush to find him. And yeah, so within a few days, he was in my possession. And then here he is, the rest is history, a month and a half ago. So it's still fairly new.
Cool. And I see him sleeping in the background. So great. Yeah. So I'd love to learn more about you. I think our audience would love to know about yourself as well. So tell us a little bit about, you know, how you kind of started into your acting. And now you're screenwriting too. So I'm interested to hear more about that as well.
Yeah. So I got into acting. I mean, the story goes for many actors. Very young age, I love performing and storytelling. But it wasn't until I was in high school, I believe I was 14, when I auditioned for my first school play ever. And yeah, that was just my first experience, like really on stage performing for an audience that wasn't just my family. And I just fell in love with the experience. I fell in love with the whole, you know, getting a script and bring, you know, taking the words and making it come to life on stage. I fell in love with the production aspect of it. Just, you know, it was the play was The Wizard of Oz. So it was a big ensemble cast. And so just getting to work with all, you know, the other students in the school and getting to sing and dance and act. So it was kind of from that point that it was fairly soon after, I think within a few months that after I finished that play, that I convinced my mom to let me get an agent, I guess, technically pursue it professionally, but it was more of a, like a fun kind of hobby thing for me at that point. And she let me, and then and then from that point on I was auditioning, and yeah, that's how I kind of first got in.
Yeah. Who did you play in The Wizard of Oz? Did you play Dorothy?
I didn't, no. I think a lot of people think that I played her, but no, I played the barrister of Munchkinland. Yeah. Not a super significant role. It meant a lot to me at the time. No, I believe I just auditioned for, and again, this is where I was still a bit timid about putting myself out there in terms of performance, because again, like I said, I didn't really do a lot of growing up in the public space. I put on shows and stuff at home. But so I believe when I auditioned for the play, it was just like general auditions to join the ensemble cast. So I believe it was just, there was like dance auditions and singing auditions. I don't even remember doing an acting audition. They just kind of assigned students to, it's like, okay, you're going to play the judge of Munchkinland. You're going to play the mayor of Munchkinland. And so, yeah, I think I literally had four lines in the whole play, but then I would sing and dance throughout the performance. So
no part is too small, right? It's just everybody. Yeah. So what, you know, so you said you were doing shows at home for your parents. So two questions come arise. Like, how did your parents really support you in your acting early on? And then did they inspire you to audition, or was it somebody at school who said you should audition for the play?
Oh, good question. My parents didn't discourage me from performance. I think my parents knew at a very young age that I again, just like loved putting on costumes and playing make-believe and all that. Again, like what so many kids do. But yeah, growing up, my family, I come from a very academic family. So like school was first and foremost, and academics first and foremost was like the focus. And then otherwise, we were a pretty athletic family. So I have three older siblings, and everyone was in various sports and activities growing up. And that was kind of what my parents knew. So academics and athletics, they didn't, I mean, I could ask them today, but I feel like the answer would be the same of just, they didn't really know if, you know, to put me in like a theater group or something. Like, they just didn't know where to kind of place me in that regard, in terms of where my interests were at a very young age. And so, no, I didn't really have them either as, I would say, like a model of, they pursued it at one point in their lives, even just as an extracurricular or a hobby or a side interest. It was very much, it felt like kind of my own thing. The one thing I will say, I know my mom did do some theater back in her day. And so that came up kind of like later on where, so maybe there's a little bit of, even just genetically, maybe I got it from her kind of thing. But in terms of the auditioning for the high school play, yeah, that's a great question, because I don't really know what inspired me to audition for it. If it was just like an instinctual, well, this is kind of like, it's just something that lights me up, so I might as well give it a shot. That's, I feel like, the best answer I can give. I don't remember there being a specific friend or family member who encouraged me. I think it was just my own, I'm going to take this leap and do it, even though it was kind of scary for me at the time.
Yeah, the universe was telling you, do it. Here's the paper, sign your name.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, your parents, your father is Chinese and your mother is Portuguese, is that correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Both immigrants from other places?
So my mom was born in Portugal, and she and her family came to Canada. I think she was six when they moved here. My dad is fourth generation Chinese, so his family's been in Canada for a long time. And
do you find your heritage in your life a lot, or is it something that's kind of like, you know, now I'm more Canadian than I am, you know, Asian, mixed Asian, Portuguese?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think growing up, I feel like my parents did a really good job, and still today, it stands true, but did a really good job of exposing me and my siblings to both cultures quite equally. And yeah, I don't really know how to answer that question, because it almost feels like, to me, like my heritage is a big part of my life. It was a big part of my life growing up and still is today, like that mixed heritage, but it wasn't something I like that was spoken about. It's just, that's just how I was raised, and that's all I knew. But yeah, I think mixed race and Canadian, it's like, I'm like all of those things. I consider myself, yeah, like it's hard to answer that question a little bit.
Yeah, I'm mixed myself, so I kind of understand, like, you know, just, is it, what is it? It's just kind of like, this is life.
Right, it's all we've ever known. I think as I get older, it's interesting because, one, I'm realizing how much I took for granted certain aspects of either culture growing up. Like, again, it felt like second nature, but also some things, you know, as a kid, I'd like roll my eyes at, just like, oh, this is ridiculous. Or in being like where I grew up, it was heavily populated by Caucasians. So, you know, to be kind of, to be mixed and to identify differently, maybe some things would come up when I was a kid that is like, oh, that would highlight that I was different from a lot of my, but yeah, as I get older, I think I'm able to maybe zone in on certain aspects of my Chinese heritage or my Portuguese heritage that I'm just like, oh, these are things that are, I really value and I want to celebrate more and honor more in my day to day or in moving forward and as I continue to build my life.
Yeah. Brings it back. You're like, oh, I really enjoyed that as a kid, but I don't do it anymore. And so how do I continue it so that I pass it on to other people too?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. It feels really fulfilling at that point too. Sometimes it's like, I think I had that at one point as well. It's just like, it feels like a hole was missing. And then when I bring it back, oh, there's something that I want to keep filling more and more with.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely.
So you said you had your mother, your father help you get an agent. I'm really curious about that, because I feel like most people, agents find you, or you have to wait for an agent to discover you. You just went to go find an agent. How did that work?
So, I mean, you can, there is the process of you, I guess you can submit to agents. You'd submit, maybe, I don't know how it is, if it's still the same today, but when I was first getting started, you could submit a photo, so a headshot, and a resume if you have any work to present, and maybe like a demo reel, and you can submit these to agents, and then they would maybe contact you if they were interested. I guess in my case, I actually was I was discovered in a sense. I was talking, I remember bringing up the idea with my mom, but then there was this like talent scout kind of thing coming through Kamloops. So they were passing through Kamloops and doing an event. And one of my friends who was, we were on the swim team, like the local swim team together. And one of my friends, she wanted to go to this, because basically you would show up at this event and they would basically say like, they give a bunch of information about potential, what was it? It was like a talent scouting convention you could potentially be invited to if they saw potential in you as someone. And it was for modeling and acting. I think it was primarily modeling, but also there was an acting component to it. And so my friend invited me to go with her because she really wanted to go and she didn't want to go alone. And so my mom let me go to this, and it was literally you show up and they line you up and then they basically say yes or no. It's like purely based on your look, which is of course so much of the industry is based on that. And it's interesting. But anyways, so I went with my friend. And I mean, it was kind of a fun thing, but I wasn't really thinking anything of it. It wasn't at that point. I was just a kid who grew up in Kamloops who liked performing. So I think I showed up and I was like in soccer shorts and a baggy t-shirt and my hair was undone. And like, I wasn't looking to impress anybody. I was just like, I'm here. And I got the yes. And it was just like, we'd love to have you come to this convention. We think if you see potential in, again, just purely based off of my look at this point. And so it was basically then me going home and convincing my mom to let me go to this convention, which was in Banff, Alberta. I believe it was being hosted in Banff. It was like over the course of a long weekend or something. It costs a lot of money. So this is also now it's just like, potentially, because there was like hundreds of people at this convention. And certainly there's a panel. There's I don't know how many, there was a lot though. There was several agents for modeling and acting. And basically it's over the course of the weekend, you're doing like runway walking and all this stuff. So they're basically like auditioning you for modeling. And then there was also an acting component where you could prepare a monologue and perform the monologue. And because I really wanted to act, I wasn't so interested in modeling. I prepared a monologue and performed it. And I ended up getting, I had, I think a total of seven modeling agencies that were really interested in signing me. So that was pretty good. And then there was two agencies for acting that were really interested there. And there was fewer agencies for acting at the convention overall. But anyways, so it kind of worked out for me, even though I doled out whatever money to go to this thing. that's how I ended up finding my very first agent based in Vancouver. And they were for modeling and acting. So it kind of worked out. And it kind of just went from there.
So you said you had several scouting you out and wanting to work with you. How did you pick which one to work
with? Yeah. So kind of hilariously, the agent I ended up signing with, so I had a friend in high school who she's still an actress today, actually. And she at the time in high school was, I think, primarily modeling, but she was getting into some commercial work as well. And she was like modeling all over. She was going to like Thailand and stuff. And it was so funny because I sat down to meet with, because basically these agents, then they show interest in you and you have these meetings with them at the convention. And I sat down to meet with this one agent and I'm looking through, I guess it's just a lookbook they have of some of their existing clients. And I flip a page and I see my friend from high school. I was like, oh my gosh, I know her. And so then we made the connection that like she repped my friend. And so there was, I think it's just a familiarity and there where it just felt like it's like, oh, if she reps my friend and she's doing so well, like maybe this is a good sign and to kind of just go with them. And because I wanted to again focus more on acting, there was no sense in just signing with one of the modeling agencies that was also interested. Yeah,
I think that's a good a way to figure out who you want to work with. One, it's a referral, so your friend already was there, and so it feels good. But yeah, I think it's really important because, you know, I'm not an actor, but you know, people want me to act. I'm like, okay, well, who would I choose if I did any acting? I know my actor friends are always looking for agents, but like, you don't know if they're going to be a scam, like you said, and who knows what it is. So, you know, I think it's really good to figure out a process and way to choose if they are just acting and modeling. There's all those points to think about.
Yeah. And I think it's a little bit different because I have friends who are, they'll, in the past few years, they've transitioned out of working with one agent and moved over to another, and the reasons were different. And I actually just last year got representation in the US. So that was a process. So my representation in Canada, who I've been with, so I'm no longer with my agent in Vancouver, but I have rep in Toronto, and I've been with Julia for over a decade now. Signing with her was, I kind of just fell into it. That's a whole other story. But in getting my rep in LA last year, I was going through that actual process of meeting with different agents and really having to make more of a decision based on like, what is it I'm looking for? Can they provide that? And then super important for me in my team is they're people I can communicate with and that we're all on the same page and that we feel comfortable with one another. So there's a lot of factors that I think go into forming that relationship.
Yeah. So what was your first gig? So I've seen like on your IMDb is like, was it Nickelodeon was your first thing? Was it something else?
No, that's my first TV and film job. So yeah, and I think I booked that was my third audition with my new agent. Mm. So I think I was 15 at the time. And yeah, it was exciting. Again, I was like coming in so green and like not knowing it. I definitely wasn't I don't know. I just like, I didn't know what to expect. I think maybe at that point I had taken like one on-camera acting class, Kent intensive. So I barely knew what I was doing, but yeah, it's clearly worked out.
Yeah. And over the years you were doing one to two, you know, episodes for every show and things here. And, but then I also, you know, was listening to another podcast. You're on the Topanga Canyon or Topanga Moon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did. I was like, let's listen to what else she's been on, but you were doing you're finishing your master's degree. You're working jobs like a vegan bakery and nannying. Like, how did you balance those things all the time? And what was the decision to, you know, continue acting?
Yeah, this is a really good question, because I think this is like a pretty integral part of my journey in the past decade, is that I basically after high school, I wanted to act, but I didn't have the courage to basically tell my parents, this is what I want to do. And I just want to move to Vancouver and pursue it professionally. And again, as I mentioned earlier, like come from a very academic family. So it was kind of just written in the stars that you're going to go and get a university degree and have that education. And then you're going to get a financially secure job. And so I completely respect my parents and everything they've done for me and my siblings. So it's like, I get it. They really wanted to provide this life and future for their kids, and which they very much have. And so following high school, I went to university. I guess because I didn't really want to do anything but act, I basically applied to a few universities for general studies, except for one in Toronto I applied to for the theater program. And then when I got into that, I was like, okay, I'm getting out of here. I'm going and studying theater, because that was kind of the closest thing I could get to like, I'm going to act. And so I went off to Toronto, I did my undergrad in theater. Following that, as you mentioned, yeah, I did a master's in communications. And that was, to be quite honest, both I was very interested in the program. It was a brand new program that had just come out. It was a joint program between York and Ryerson Universities in Toronto. And it was a really interesting program. But I was also kind of buying time, because I had finished my theater degree and I was just like, what am I going to do now? What do you do with the theater degree? And still here wanting to pursue acting professionally, but not. And at this point, it was kind of also, it wasn't just like me lacking the courage to, I guess, say to my parents, this is what I want to do. It was lacking the courage in myself to be able to like, this is what I want to do and I can do it. It is possible. So I did my master's degree, and at the same time, I'm working these side jobs and then pursuing act kind of on the side and hoping that like something will just land and it'll sweep me off my feet and I'll be set and I won't have to worry about doing that transition. It'll just, acting will just happen for me. And it wasn't happening that way. So I was working a lot of, like you said, I was nannying, I was working in restaurants, I was working at a bakery, just trying to balance all these jobs to pay the bills. And still at this point, not booking enough to be able to, like booking enough acting jobs to be able to rely on that solely as my financial income and to really pursue that full time. So then because I was getting tired of working all these odd jobs, it was kind of during my master's that I became more interested in this, but I got heavily interested in holistic nutrition. And it was to do with some personal health concerns. But yeah, my master's, I ended up doing my master's thesis on topics related to nutrition and the lack of nutritional literacy. So basically how people don't know anything about nutrition and their own health. And that kind of led to just, again, my own like personal education on these topics. But because I was tired of working all these Joe jobs to pay the bills, I was really trying to think hard on what is something I could do that I could still have flexibility in my schedule so that I could go to auditions. But that was something I maybe enjoyed a little bit more than working at restaurants, working at a bakery. And I thought of holistic nutrition. So I went back to school and became a holistic nutritionist. And that allowed me to then, I set up my own business. So I had basically a consulting business where I was working with clients one-on-one, doing a lot of consulting with various actual like businesses in Toronto where I was doing a lot of recipe development for them. That basically allowed me though, set my own hours, have flexibility in my schedule so that I could continue to pursue acting. So it's kind of funny because I'll joke about how I became a nutritionist so that I could actually continue to pursue acting. And then it was just within, I think, two-ish years of working as a nutritionist. And again, I was still pursuing acting, that acting just started to kind of take off. I had a moment where I did start to feel creatively unfulfilled in just pursuing my nutrition trajectory, that I realized, oh, I need to pursue acting full time. Otherwise it's like, if I'm never going to take this risk, like what am I waiting for kind of thing. And so I remember having like a mental switch about it. I didn't really do anything on the physical plane differently, but then all of a sudden just more auditions started rolling in and I just started booking consistently. So I don't know if that's like the power of manifestation and just like mindset and just putting it out in the universe and then, you know, seeing what comes. But yeah, there was like one day I woke up and I was just like, I'm being creatively unfulfilled right now, just staying in the nutrition space as much as I love it. And yeah, then I slowly, as I started to work more in the acting industry, I was able to transition pretty seamlessly out of my work as a nutritionist. I just basically saved up a lot of money so that I could fully take that leap. And then, yeah, like kind of bet on myself, to be honest.
No, I think that's great. I think that's the thing that people can kind of forget. Like this is an art form, and because it's not paid very well, especially at the beginning, finding another job. But I think what I learned very early on was, you know, being an entrepreneur, finding your way to make money, not someone else's thing. When you have your own time, your own self income, you're able to save up, use that. Like if money equals time, then you can use your money to buy yourself time to pursue acting, pursue your creative goals. And I think there's one way to go about it, I think, that I like, because it's like some way to, when you're setting your own hours, you can take other time to do other things, which is really useful for your own energy and focus on how to develop that career.
Yeah, no, totally. And yeah, it just took me a really long time to get there.
Does. It never stops. So I'll give you the option to take this, but I do want to talk about the time you had lupus. And so if that's something you're okay with talking about that for a minute?
Yeah.
Okay. I have a question about it. So for our other audience, when you were younger, you had to deal with lupus, which is an autoimmune disease where your body's immune system attacks your own tissues and organs, but it also shows up in your skin. And as an actor, you know, your looks are a huge part of your career. Did that affect your career and in that way, or even just the way you presented yourself? And, you know, what did you learn from this experience?
Yeah. So yeah, it's really interesting. So lupus is so unique in that it can be different for everybody, and it can essentially, the condition can attack different organs or systems within the body. For me, and yeah, it can affect every skin. For me, that seems to be like the organ that it affects mostly. And by that I mean, so if I am experiencing what would be referred to as a lupus flare-up, so when you have a lot of inflammation in the body and then you start to show more of these severe symptoms, for me that does look like, and when I was first diagnosed, I did have like lesions all over my body, kind of like rash-like lesions. I also had the very distinctive, it's called a malar or butterfly rash. It's like a rash that goes across the bridge of the nose and up like the upper cheeks. And so right from the get-go, it was something that was definitely affecting my skin. And then over the years, if I have had a flare up, and I've been really fortunate to to be able to manage most of my symptoms just with diet and lifestyle. That's something that I kind of came to on my own years and years ago now. But if I am, how do I put it? Not even just a lupus flare-up, but if my immune system's suppressed, if I'm run down, I think for me, a big thing is like if I am experiencing chronic stress, which, and this probably goes for most people, but my body will start to really fight back, but in a way, you know, it'll retaliate. And I'll start to see that in symptoms of, I'll get eczema in various spots on my skin. And this, again, I hear this with lots of people when they're under stress. Psoriasis is also another thing. And that's like, that is known also to be autoimmune. And then for me too, a big one is acne. So in my mid 20s, I had, since my diagnosis in my teens, it was in my mid 20s that I had my biggest flare up. And it was during a time that I was going through a traumatic and tumultuous breakup. And so emotionally, I was going through a lot and my body just shut down physically. And I developed a rash all over my body that was incredibly uncomfortable and painful. And I also developed acne at that time. And before that point, I'd always had actually pretty good skin in terms of acne. And so I was just like, what's going on? Like, I'm not a teen anymore. I shouldn't be having these breakouts. But I've learned, and it's something I've had to honestly kind of manage over the years. And it was at that time, actually, that was one of my many breaks from the industry, was following that breakup. And when I was having this flare up and it was affecting my skin, because it got to the point, I remember I was still auditioning and sending in like audition tapes and all this stuff. And I finally got to a point where I just couldn't cover up with makeup. And it just didn't like, and it was affecting my confidence as an actor, and I wasn't feeling good about my work. And so I had to take a step back for almost 2 years at that time until I healed. And yeah, does that answer your question? I can't remember. There was some, yeah.
No, well, what, you know, I think we learned a lot here. Just, you know, what was your, not even just experience, but, you know, how you dealt with it. You took time to step away from the industry, right? And manage your stress, manage what was going on in life. And I think that's completely, not only valid, but a good step to take. And then you dealt with your diet. So you and your holistic nutrition, you know, you said, I think you heard in the other podcast, we were very thinking about what you were eating. And I think that really affects us, how our body works. And so, you know, I just think it was just something I'd heard on the other thing. And I think that's really important to think about how we take care of our bodies in such a terribly stressful industry. You know, that's something that we need to work on ourselves as well. So I just wanted to, you know, touch upon that. So thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
But now you're on a Netflix show, Lock and Key, for season 1 and 2. This is your, you know, from your other shows, this is your longest episodic role in a series. So I'm curious, you know, how did this role come about, and like, what was your experience? Do you enjoy it? And, you know, I'd love to hear about what's it working like on this?
Yeah. So the role came about, I auditioned, oh my gosh, it feels like forever ago. I was so much younger then. No, I believe I was actually at a film festival, the Whistler Film Festival, promoting a movie I was in, when I got the call to audition for Jackie, which I later learned they had been looking for an actor to play this role for like several months prior to when I auditioned, and they just couldn't find anyone. And then I think it was coming down to crunch time, and so in the initial round of auditions, I wasn't seen. But I think the reason I found that out was because I had some other actor acquaintances who had auditioned for the role, but again, like 6-8 months prior to when I did. And so I get this audition, you just put it on tape, send it in. And then within a few days, I had received notice that they wanted to bring me in to do a chemistry read with Connor, who plays Tyler. And so then, yeah, so the next week I was in this chemistry read and it went pretty well, I guess. And yeah, I've really enjoyed my time on the show. It is nice when you get to stick around for a while and kind of form relationships with the people you're working with. You're not just doing, it's not just like you're coming in for a few days or an episode here and there. Yeah, we all became like family. And then just in terms of my role, it's also just fun to get to live with a character for a little while and get to grow and develop with yeah, as their arc evolves and everything. So yeah, I've really loved my time on the show.
No, that's cool. When did you start shooting that?
The first season we started in February of 2019.
Yeah, it's been a while.
It feels so, I mean, I know it's only been what, 2.5 years since? It feels like it's been like 20 years.
Yeah, this last couple of years and really throwing time away. So, okay, so then what's it like, you know, shooting it back to 2019, you probably finished around, you know, March, May, somewhere around there, maybe a little further, but somewhere in 2019, right?
Yeah.
Somewhere, right? What's it like to have this show then released during the pandemic and you're not able to go on tours or press releases and all that stuff? And, you know, are you, is it just like comfort from your own home just to see yourself and see the popularity? Or, you know, how's that experience, the post PR kind of?
Yeah, it's a lot more fun if you can go places. Yeah, so with the first season, it was so great because I guess we had our first season premiere, because we did have a premiere in real life. It was about a year after we started filming the first season. And that first season premiere, we were in LA for it. And it was actually right before kind of things locked down. So we were really lucky that we got to have that. And it was so much fun. And yeah, it's just so much more fun to be able to like talk in real life. Is, you know, as nice as it is to like be able to communicate with people over Zoom and whatnot, it's just not the same. And so this year, or this season coming out, and like you said, the show coming out during the pandemic, and it's definitely different and an adjustment, but it's kind of wild because you do realize that it, like, how resilient and adaptable we are as humans, because it does also kind of feel just like, oh, this is just like the new way of doing things. And as much as it would be great to have, you know, to be able to engage with people more in person right now, yeah, it's just kind of how it is. And sometimes there can be, I guess, pros to being in your own home and comfort of your own home and having these conversations. It's also quite kind of like, it's very personal, right? Like, I'm kind of in your space right now and you're also in mine. So yeah, it's an interesting experience.
What was the biggest lesson or biggest challenge you had during this whole experience for Lock and Key, or and balancing both being at home now in the pandemic, but also just, you know, now this is you're in the second season part of it. You've now developed longer relationships with your cast and crew. What's been the biggest lesson you've learned?
Oh, wow. Particularly, I'm going to answer this in terms of, I think, something I've really been impacted by and learned in the past couple of years in my line of work is how isolating it can be to be in my industry. I'm going to say particularly as an actor, just because I'm speaking as an actor. I've been having this conversation with some of my actor friends recently. And as some of us have been, you know, I lived in Toronto for many, many years, and I moved to Vancouver just before actually things locked down and the pandemic really happened. And so I then went back to Toronto last fall to film season two, but Toronto was no longer, like, I didn't have my space. It was very much, I was being put up in condo by the production while I was there. And so essentially it was like kind of like hotel living. And it was the first time for me really getting hit with just how lonely it can be if you're not careful and if you aren't making an effort to connect with other people, how lonely it can be as an actor, especially when you're traveling and you're ending up in a new city or something and you don't know anybody. And maybe you're not always working every day with your casting crews. You're not seeing people regularly. But just, yeah, all the kind of aspects of that. And then how also on top of that, as of the pandemic, where we have, in terms of auditions, we're, as an actor, we're doing all of our stuff on tape for ourselves and then submitting it. And so we're also not having that time outside of our homes to engage with people in the audition room. We're just by ourselves constantly. And so... so something, I guess, to answer your question about what I've learned is how isolating it is, but then to go with that, how important it is to make sure I'm also prioritizing connecting with people. And this is something, connection is just like a major thing I value in my life in general. And so, yeah, it's been a bit, and I know it's been compounded by, again, the couple years that we've had with the pandemic and just everyone, I think, feeling, regardless of whether or not in my industry, but everyone just feeling isolated or disconnected from people. So yeah, does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, totally. I think, you know, next one was kind of like the biggest lesson to learn throughout your journey, but I think that's a big part of it too. You know, I think just connection beyond the work, because they could do the work all the time. You could be in auditions, you can be acting, even as crew. It's like, if you're not also not making friends, but also just being with other people beyond set or beyond the chemistry rooms, yeah. You know, finding other common interests or other people to be with, to go hang with. Because I think that's because the industry is so small, it's so, it becomes social, but then you find that if you're, especially when you're like another location where you're all at, none of you are at home, but to then have your own hotel rooms and stuff like that, to make the conscious effort to be, to do stuff outside as well. I think that's really important.
Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely.
Is that one of the biggest lessons you've learned over your entire career? Or is there something that you feel like you, like advice, like I'm trying to get to is like, what advice would you give to other emerging actors like yourself?
I mean, one piece is to kind of go off what you're just saying about, I do think it's really important to do other things. And this is where I, as much as it took me such a long time to step into, to really follow my heart and step into acting and pursue it, you know, full time, I have no regrets in the trajectory I took, and the fact that I also very much celebrate the fact that I do have a, like, just other interests in life. And I think that's really important. And I think, like you were just saying, like, I think it's because this industry can be, it can feel like overstimulating in a lot of ways too. So I think it is really healthy. And as I've mentioned previously, like, I've taken multiple breaks over, you know, the 15 years that I've technically been in the industry, I've taken many breaks along the way. And I think that can be really healthy and important to just take a step back and reevaluate and just figure out, like, you know, reevaluate, like, why you're doing it is a really good one. But also just, like, go off and do other things. Go travel. Go, again, like, connect with other people outside the industry. Certainly, like, dip your toes into other hobbies or interests that maybe you didn't think you'd be interested in, but you are. And, you know, you might surprise yourself. And I think all these things can help make you, for actors, make actors a more well-rounded and in their work to begin with. So yeah, that's a big one. And then I'd say, if I can give another one, it would be to just take the risk. And that's, like, both in life as an actor and in the business of acting, like, take a chance on yourself, bet on yourself, do what I eventually got to doing. Again, it took me my time to get there, which is totally fine. And then also in your work as an artist, take a risk as well. I think that's another big thing I've learned in the past few years, is just, like, be bold in your choices. And if you fall flat on your face, like, you'll learn. I just feel like I feel very confidently that you'll learn something in the process. And if you learn something, I don't really see that as a failure by any means, right? It's actually kind of a win. So,
yeah, I think as on the other episode, it's like fail the first attempt in learning, right?
Yeah, that's great.
No, I think that's going to be definitely the title of the episode, is take risks and bet on yourself, right? I think that's the really big takeaways. And I think a lot of people are afraid to bet on themselves because it's a risk too. But I think it's really important that we believe in ourselves, take that chance. And if we are really passionate about it and can really put the effort into it, we can do it.
Yeah, and I think that's actually, with all what we're saying, is just, like, the past couple years with the pandemic as well, and just the realness of uncertainty in life. And, like, there's so much, I think for me, I've lived with, and as, you know, artists, we live with that uncertainty in or entrepreneurs, you know, we live with that uncertainty in our work. But the last few years with the pandemic really highlighted, I think, just uncertainty in life in general. And so, yeah, almost kind of this feeling of, you got nothing to lose. Go for it.
Yeah, for sure. What's the one thing you want to be most known for? Like, what's the legacy you want to...
Oh, wow. Okay. I think this actually ties in quite nicely with, not to repeat myself over and over again, but with the notion of risk-taking and having courage. It sounds so maybe broad, but... just, yeah, in life in general, I would love to be known as somebody who took risks, did the things even though I was afraid, and doing all of that with integrity, and for, you know, where I'm still in alignment with myself and not selling out. But Yeah, I think taking risks, because as we've been saying, I think that goes back to a lot of not just betting on yourself, but and taking a chance on yourself. But I think that comes with building self-trust. I say that with a question mark on the end, but I
no, but yeah, I get that.
I think, and that's something self-trust is something I've been acutely aware of in my own life for the past several years, kind of just like looking at what that means to me, how that shows up in my life or does not show up. I think we live in a culture and a society that's constantly telling us how to be and who we are and what's right, what's wrong. And I think, kind of drowning out some of that noise and getting quiet with ourselves and figuring out, taking back our power and figuring out what is best for you and then trusting that. And then acting from that place to then take risks and be courageous and do the thing, even though you're afraid. And then, like, as you said, bringing it back to what you said about what was mentioned in another podcast of failure, the first step in learning. And what are we without learning and growth? And like, it kind of just never ends. And I think that's what can make life and living so exciting.
Yeah. I like that self-trust. And, if you're going to, we're all going to make mistakes, and it's not, you're going to be your first. It's not going to be your last. just take on that. It's like, you're just going to have to pick yourself up the next day and keep trying. Cause it's not going to, if you trust in yourself that you know what you're doing, that you feel right. And you feel that even if you don't think it's right for you, you just know it's good for you. It's the thing you want to do, to trust that instinct. I think that's really valuable to think about. Mm-hmm. So one last couple questions, what would you be doing if you weren't acting?
If I wasn't acting, I'd probably be doing one of two things. There's a good chance I'd be doing something within the holistic wellness space. It is something I'm very passionate about and something I see myself, like I still want to have a presence in that space. It is taking a little bit of a back seat in my life right now, but as I was developing my business, so as I mentioned, I was doing like a lot of consulting work. But it was kind of at the juncture of as I transitioned into acting full time that I had really found my footing in the holistic wellness space. And I was really figuring out what it was that I like really lit me up in that world. And I had started to host these dinner events where I would curate and design a menu that was seasonal, local, like featuring seasonal, local fare. And the idea was to bring people together. I believe I called them mindful eating dinner events. And the mindful aspect of it was simply just bringing people together to share a meal with one another, to be present with one another and with the food they're consuming. And then, like I said, to feature local seasonal ingredients. I have a lot of fun in the kitchen, so I love to develop recipes, and that's again a creative aspect in that space for me. So I had a lot of fun developing the menus for the event, and I believe so. I got to do one event, and it went so well. I probably could have sold way more tickets, but I wanted to keep it very intimate. I literally had like 10 to 12 people. It was intimate and so lovely, and I was planning to do. I had the second dinner event in the works. But then I booked an acting job that unfortunately the dates conflicted with the date of the event. And I had to, it was like, that was like a very interesting like telling point. Just like, okay, I got to pick and choose here. And I chose acting, of course. There was something about these events and what I really, again, because before that I was consulting with clients on just like one-on-one work of how to, help them with their own personal health and how to alter their diet and lifestyle and that sort of thing. Which has its own fulfillment, but I really loved the experience of bringing people together around food. I think that's also, it goes back to just how I was raised, and both my cultures are big on food and sharing food experiences, and very much my part of my wellness philosophy is that food can be all of fuel, medicine and joy. And so that's also what I wanted to highlight with these dinners, is that we can have like really delicious food, but it can also be nourishing and good for us. And part of that nourishment is the coming together and being present with one another and present with the food. And then the seasonal aspect of the dinner events too is to really highlight wellness and we as humans living in sync with the seasons and in sync with nature and nature cycles, which I think is one of the best ways for us all to be well and healthy. So something in that space, something maybe to do, like, I just want to throw dinner parties, basically. But yeah, that's probably either that, or I've always said if I were to go back to school for something, I'm really into architectural design. So if I were to go back to school for anything, I would probably go back to school and become an architect.
It's so great. And I think it's really important to think about gatherings. The Art of Gathering is a great book by, I forgot her name right now, but, you know, gathering people, but also around the food and in sync with nature and understanding what's healthy right now, what's fresh. Now, and then that it could heal not only our bodies, but our souls as a food, but so it's home cooking, it's people. I think that's a really great way to think about it. And, you know, it could be room for both in your future, that bring your actor friends together and your crew and all that stuff. So that's fantastic. And you said you're screenwriting right now. Is this, you know, I'm looking, you know, what are you working on now? And is this screenwriting something you're going to try to pursue even further?
Yeah. So I'm writing my first script and it's incredibly daunting. And the process has been very slow for me. I've been saying for the past year that I'm working on a script. And so it's ongoing. And I'm very much at a point in my career where, one, in terms of like the next thing I'd like to be a part of in terms of acting, I'm being much more selective about what those projects are. I really want to be able to connect with the content that I'm, again, putting out in the world. And so sometimes that means the pickings are slim, to be quite honest. Mm. And so all that to say, I also, yeah, like end of last year, I was just like, I think I need to put my own ideas down on paper and start putting out my own stories. And so I started working on this script earlier this year. And it's very much a personal story about, very much based on my childhood and growing up mixed race. So it touches on a lot of themes of racism, identity, belonging, and not belonging. Those ideas can be very much a coming of age. And yeah, right now a lot of the ideas and the script is very jumbled, but I hope to get it out there at some point for sure. And yeah, moving forward, I think I do see that as like a big part of my future is writing, and I'd love to eventually get into directing and producing as well.
Good. Good. Get those stories. I mean, anything we should be keeping a lookout for in the future? Obviously, you know, go watch Lock and Key on Netflix right now. But is there something else that we should be keeping an eye out for?
I mean, Lock and Key. But otherwise, like I said, I'm working with my team right now to kind of find the next thing. And maybe I'll be the next prominent Marvel superhero. But yeah.
We wanted to continue our conversation a little deeper into your ethnicity, your background, you know, just figuring out more cultural awareness about different things. So, you know, what would you like to bring up today? Do you have something on your mind specifically?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm just interested in discussing representation in the industry and the lack thereof. And I think maybe a little bit of what it means to be of mixed race in the industry, because that's a very specific thing. And yeah, what that experience is as an actor, but also what can we do moving forward within the industry to again, just have more representation and to highlight authentic stories of individuals of mixed race.
Yeah, mixed race is a pretty hot topic. I think there's a lot of controversy between, you know, actors and just how to cast. Being mixed myself, it's a very different way. And you know, some people are present mixed Asian. Some people don't present mixed Asian. They present not Asian, whatever it might be. So I think that's a conversation to be had. So what are your thoughts about being mixed in casting? What are some, do you find issues within casting being not Asian enough or too Asian for this or that, certain types of roles?
Yeah, no, it's definitely something that actually touches me quite personally, because at a very young age, I knew, and it might not have been something I could name or identify, but I knew intuitively at a very young age, I think, how my whiteness, so my mom being Portuguese, how my whiteness and the notion of being white, how that allowed certain provisions or gave me certain things such as acceptance, opportunity, privilege. And so at a very young age, knowing that, but not really knowing, like, it wasn't something I discussed with my family or anybody. It was just something I observed. It had me, in a sense, want to lean more into my whiteness. Because I wanted, like I think all people, you know, I wanted opportunity. I wanted to be accepted. I wanted to belong. I wanted to feel included. And in leaning more into my whiteness, though, I very much rejected my Asian heritage. And this is something, like, I think I experienced most of my life, where I just, you know, I saw that there was, again, more opportunity in being white. And in my case, like, I think white passing is another thing to look at, because in being white passing, I'm also, you know, that's like also a step above someone who is, you know, has both their parents are Asian, and or one parent's Asian, one is white, but they identify or look, and I, correct me, but like more Asian, quote unquote, right? Mm-hmm. Like, again, yeah. What you were saying, like some people, depending on our mix. And so, yeah, at a very young age, I understood the privileges of my whiteness, and in so many ways then rejected my Asianness. And so coming to an industry where now it's like, I mean, as an actor, we're already just bombarded with, I think, this sense of not enoughness. Like, you're not tall enough. You're not short enough. You're not skinny enough. You're not fat enough. You're not blue-eyed enough, whatever it is. And so to add on to that, you're not white enough or you're not Asian enough, that is something that kind of permeates my experience as a mixed actor, because it goes, again, much deeper to like this, like, personal thread of like, I don't know where I fit then. And this, again, is why, going back to originally what I was saying about, I think it's so important to have these, you know, to authentically represent the mixed experience on screen, is because it is so unique. I have a number of mixed friends, and they've felt the same in terms of like, where do I fit? What is my identity? It's kind of confusing.
Yeah. And I think mixed identities have that factor of not feeling in one place or the other, not fitting in. And just, I feel like, you know, you said you had went along with being white passing and kind of what a life attributed to white circles. Did you have Asian circles around you or Asian communities around you growing up?
Where I grew up, it was predominantly white. Most of the Asian community I felt that I knew of in the town I grew up in were international students at the local college. And it wasn't until I moved to Toronto after high school, and it's so multicultural and diverse there. I felt really at home there in so many ways, and I just felt very comfortable in that space. One of my best friends growing up, though, and she's Chinese. And yeah, other than that, though, like, I wasn't, and other than my family, so my dad's side, there wasn't this vast Asian community that I was a part of. And so I was mostly, yeah, predominantly surrounded by a white community. And so, like I said, leaning more into my white culture and being white passing, it again, it kind of allows for this like feeling of safety. Yeah, like, I'm going to be more accepted if I lean into this, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I feel like I had similar childhood. You know, I feel like I rejected my parents. My dad told me to reject my Asianness. And so we didn't spend time with, I wasn't in Asian communities. Being mixed white, it's just like, we were white community, white holidays with my white family members. And so I never got to choose, and it was never a place for me to choose. But I did, when I went to college, and then a couple of times in high school, when I went to other Asian high schools, just to visit or something like that, or Asian areas, I didn't feel very accepted by Asian people either. Did you have a similar thing? Did you just feel like you were kind of rejected by other Asians for not being Asian enough, or?
Yeah, I felt, yeah, there were some circles or some communities where I definitely felt that. And even in my own family, like, again, on my dad's side, he's the oldest of six, and all of his siblings married Asian men and women, and had, you know, had many children. So all my cousins on that side are are full Asian. And so anytime there's a family gathering and just we're kind of, I have three older siblings. So like the four of us would just be these mixed kids amongst all these Asian kids. And again, growing up, it wasn't like a thing. It wasn't something we really discussed or made a big deal about, but I do feel like a part of me even then just, again, intuitively felt like I didn't quite belong. And then on the other side of it with my mom's family, I don't have as many cousins on that side, but yeah, to be the slightly different looking kids because our dad was Asian was also just such an interesting experience. Yeah.
Now, because you, let me think of this, how do I get this? Because of the being in wide circles and kind of personality and just relationships being more white, predominantly white, did you feel fully accepted? Or were you sometimes having to make, not decisions, but make compromises to fit into a white community if you didn't feel like you're pointed out for being Asian, or what are you kind of question? Did you ever feel like you just kind of put up with things because this was now your community?
Yeah, that what you're asking, it makes me think of, I mean, also the notion that, you know, of whether or not I've experienced racism or, you know, in any kind of form. And I've certainly experienced a number of microaggressions, and it's, you know, so many of us, I think, have in terms of labels and stereotypes. And yeah, I would say for me, I've had to work through some guilt there, because yeah, I very much willingly in wanting to be accepted by my circles of white community and my peers, I participated in that. Like I allowed certain microaggressions and stereotypes like that were being imposed on me to occur. And even if they felt kind of off, like, you know, haha, it's a joke, but part of me knew it wasn't right. Like it just didn't feel good. But then yes, then there's another part of me that just wanted to be accepted and belong. And if it means that I'm going to be, you know, the mixed one in my friends group, or a big one, and this I actually see in the industry too. And I know it's changing, but I still see it sometimes as being mixed, and you're just so exotic, and so that idea, and again, it being either joked about or even celebrated in certain circles, and I very much, yeah, I went along with it. I participated because, yeah, I was young, and I wanted to just be accepted by my peers, and it within those circles. So yeah.
Right. Yeah, I feel like that happens to a lot of people. And one of the reasons why I asked that question to kind of lead us into is like, do you feel the same way within Hollywood? I feel like Hollywood is predominantly white circles, and to be, you know, just be more, to want to be accepted and to want to play the game. It's like having, can't be speaking out, can't speak up about something, can't fight back because you don't, you know, because these people are in Hollywood. They're the ones who are trying to make the things happen. They're the ones running this show. So do you feel like you have to zip your lip a little more because you can't speak up, can't new ideas? And then if you do bring up ideas, they're shut down.
Yeah, this is a great question. I think you asking this question and us having this conversation about it is a really good place to start, because yeah, we just need to talk about these things more and kind of put them out in the open, because as you're saying, it is, you know, I, as an actor, I want to work and I want to have a job, but so I don't want to, you know, step on anyone's toes. And yeah, a lot of, you know, at the top of the Hollywood food chain is white people. And so just going to say it. And yeah, I, you know, as I get older though, it comes down to just like making decisions and acting with integrity. So I've had to make some choices, particularly in the past few years, where I will turn down roles or projects because of when I read the script or I read the character breakdown or something, it's just not something I care to, again, support or represent, because maybe it is a stereotype. I've had a number of conversations with my team and my reps about just, again, certain tropes that I'm not willing to to engage with anymore, and I don't want to support them. And I think, and I talk about this with actor friends of mine who are also people of color, and how we, this is where we need to, where we can make change is in turning down those narratives and stand up for the roles we should, like, for more dynamic roles, for roles that aren't just where we're stereotypes, for things where there aren't microaggressions happening. And certainly my, like, my Caucasian actor friends too, this is where they can also just, like, you know, if they're getting a script and there's a Black character in the script and they're being portrayed in a way that's just, like, not supportive of again, the representation we should be having on screen, and it's not authentic, then it's also, I believe, up to those Caucasian actors to also say no, don't do it. And yeah, it's hard because, I've turned in a number of opportunities in the past few years that could have been jobs, it could have been money, it could have been like food in my mouth, but it's standing up for, I think, what you believe in, like, what, get behind something that you're passionate about. And it's, I'm passionate about having, again, authentic representation on screen and telling stories that are going to move the needle. And I feel like we have a really long way to go. So we got to keep plugging away. Like, we can't stop now, you know?
Yeah. I think there's having that authentic storytelling and authentic representation on screen is where a lot of people are trying to go for right now. That's a weird phrase. They're trying to promote more of that part of it into it. I know we've talked about representation in the past, and honestly, I'm tired of the conversation about representation in specific ways. If it's just like general representation, I'm kind of over it. Mainly because I've watched so many movies with Asian American actors since the 80s. Like, I've watched old classics, and like, well, it's always been there. Now it's like, how do we be authentic about what we're doing? And the storytellers who are telling the story to then have those people in there and written that way. So a part of that is this now question of, you know, because it's always a controversy when something like this comes out, is when a mixed race, mixed Asian plays someone who's supposed to be full Asian. For example, like, Crazy Rich Asians got a lot of flack for Henry Golding. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it comes down to, what is the story that we're trying to tell? So if the fact that a character, if they're written as full Asian, and that's really integral to the messaging, the story that's trying to be told, then I think they should authentically cast full Asian. If casting a mixed Asian actor to play that character, and then obviously the character is becoming also mixed Asian, if it's not going to affect the overall story, then I think that's okay. But there, again, going back to, there's been a number of times in the past few years that I've turned down roles. Like, a big thing I say no to is, again, when I'll get a script, and I audition all the time for characters that have been written as full Asian. And it's a bit frustrating for me because, again, I just, and this is maybe, again, my own little shadow piece, but it's just like, I'm too white for this. Like, again, if they want to authentically tell the story, and so that's where I've said no to certain things, but I'm just like, for them to really do justice to this story, it's not my story to tell. They need to cast someone who is full Asian for this. So I'll just, like, say no right away. Sometimes there's a certain opportunity that come my way, and I'll be like, okay, I'll audition for this, because maybe there's an opportunity to maybe change the narrative slightly, and it's not going to affect the overall story. But I do think there's, like, a missing piece here. And even going back to what you were just saying previously, and this conversation of representation, and we have to go back to, it's not just actors and what we're portraying on screen, but it's like, who's the creative team behind it? Like, the producers, the writers. I think where there's a missing link or something here, and I'm not sure what the answer is, but I feel like we got to get really clear. And we as in writers, producers, got to get really clear on what is the story they're wanting to tell, and then conveying that to, I guess, casting directors. And then who are the casting directors, you know, calling on to audition or for parts and stuff? Because, I don't know, I guess just speaking from my own experience, it can be really frustrating as an actor when a casting director is reaching out for me to audition for a part, and I just don't see how they're obviously asking me for a reason to read for the part, but it's so much of our industry is based on looks, and I just don't see how I can fit certain roles. And unless they were, again, to change, to go back to the writers, and the writers want to change the whole story to be about somebody who looks more like me as opposed to somebody who has two Asian parents, then yeah, I don't know. Is that making sense? I'm not articulating myself, but yeah, there's like a something that's missing there, some kind of communication, and I'm not sure how to, like, what the steps forward look like.
And this is an open conversation. I don't think there is a right answer. I think this is something that we want to start the conversation. I don't think this conversation gets had at great lengths. I think one of the things that one of the missing pieces is having representation in casting, right? So just the casting directors being Asian, being able to, can you play someone who is Vietnamese, someone who is Chinese? And I think there's always this, you can always hope that the writers are going to change the characters. Probably not. And it's, but again, if they're Asian writers, what is the story, right? Is the story an Asian American story just about Americans Asians in America in this, I don't know, a dance competition, a beauty contest, a spelling bee? Those are different things than someone who is a historical only for this community type of thing, right? So I think there's always the opportunity of, if you're doing this story about, let's just go to the dance competition once, I think that's easy. You know, you can, someone who's Filipino, a whole Filipino family could be that. But if it ends up being someone who's, you start to cast the main lead actor as, you know, Chinese, then you change the whole family to being Chinese. But it doesn't necessarily need to change the story about what that is. You can change certain beliefs, the way they might change and make decision making, and why the family makes certain decisions over the others, how many family members there are, but that doesn't change the story. It just changed, like, the, I don't want to call them the setting, but the family setting of what people, how people interact with each other. And I think that's, there becomes that difference. Now, in from my opinion, it's like being mixed, I present pretty Asian. I know for most Asians, like, you might say, like, you might be mixed, but especially my grandma, they're like, you're definitely mixed. You're not. You're Japanese. Like, oh, come on. But, you know, I recognize I do look an Asian way. Some people look at me, Asian. I'm not going to second guess, maybe mixed, especially if they're not Asian. And so I think there is that aspect of knowing how you present. As much as you are what you are, how you present is what Hollywood sees and what we see visually. So I think that's one of those things that's, it's a background content that we're not going to know. I've seen stories with mixed Asians who don't look Asian, but they add Asian things in there. Maybe their parents are Asian, I think. And then, like, it can make sense. But if it doesn't add to the story, does it really need to be there? And so there's, you can add certain, I don't know. It's again, it's a continuing conversation. I will have this more with even our partners at Mixed Asian Media, because they have a lot of that information. They have a lot of understanding of what that looks like and changing that part. But as someone like yourself who is going into these roles, having to turn down roles that could give you money in your pocket, you know, because we all got our work. I think that's the other part of the conversation, is, you know, taking the roles when they're not. I think that's a part of our newfound responsibility, is if you're not, you know, I'm Japanese or being Chinese, taking someone who's over a very underrepresented community, like a Hmong community or Southeast Asian community, to be like, are you taking those roles? I think that's the bigger question here, not necessarily even mixed, because that's just a different way, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, honestly, like, a question I ask myself often when I get a breakdown for a role and it's an Asian character, it just, yeah, if I play this role and when the project comes out, am I going to be proud to promote it and share it and what the story's about? And if there's any tinge of, no, I'm going to feel like I took this part from somebody else. And this, again, it's just, like, not my story to tell. Like you said, I think, yeah, that's a great responsibility to have. Yeah. And if you want to actually have progress in the industry.
Yeah. Well, until Hollywood and casting and directors and all the producers start to think about how they're doing that casting. Cause I know there's not a lot of Asian casting agents or casting directors. I know a few, but, like, they can't serve us all. And same with the agencies. You know, I'm about to have a meeting with a modeling agency this week, and I'm, like, very glad that most of the representation is East Asian people. I'm like, this is great. So they know exactly where to place me, who to talk to, what the thing is. I think that that matters, because then we're starting to have a bigger conversation and where you're being put on as an equal as well. And so in Asians, mixed Asian storytelling, is there anything nowadays that you see that's doing really well that you like? Or is there just not enough to even find any?
I feel like there's not enough. I feel, yeah, I go back to this all the time, but I just feel like we still have such a long way to go. And that, again, the mixed Asian, the mixed race experience is so unique. And I feel, yeah, that there's just not enough where we're actually getting to see and experience what that uniqueness looks like. So like you were saying, sure, there. So even like my character unlocking key, nowhere does it say like I have an Asian mom and a white dad or something. You know, people, fans of the show, a lot of them have noted that I'm a half Asian actress. And so there's a lot of, I think, conversation and excitement around that. Just like, again, oh, it's so nice to see myself represented on screen. Like I get a lot of messages from fans and stuff like that, which is so wonderful. But yeah, it's not a part of the story. Like you were saying, there's so many of these that where there are mixed Asian characters on screen, but it's not something that's necessarily been highlighted. I would like to see the stories highlighted more. Like I would like to see, like, well, what does it mean to be mixed Asian? Or what does it mean to be mixed race? What is that like unique experience of being Chinese Jamaican? Or, you know, what was that childhood like? And I mean, on the one hand, it's kind of exciting that there's not enough of that out there right now, that there's like, okay, so great. Here's some ideas for storytelling then. Like, let's start digging into this material. And there's just so much. And I think, yeah, to really honor and celebrate individuals who just aren't represented on screen enough, that, yeah, I would just like to see more of it.
What kind of those unique experiences do you think should be portrayed? I mean, there's a lot of them. There's a lot of different conflicts, ways of being, family. I think mostly it's going to be family. But what, you know, give us some examples. I feel like there's a lot of, you know, our listeners not all mixed. So it's like, what is that conversation? What do you want to be a part of that conversation?
Yeah, maybe now my wheels are turning. I'm like, well, there's like, on the one hand, so in terms of family, like I think about my parents, my dad's Chinese, my mom's Portuguese. And when they came together, it was, you know, my Chinese grandmother actually, like, she didn't approve of my mother. Like she very much wanted my dad to marry a Chinese woman. And so there was conflict there. And then it's like that, just them coming together at the time that they did, it's just, yeah, the differences of culture and of race was rare to see. And like I said, where I grew up, there was no other really mixed families. So there's that. There's, I think, you kind of got me thinking about, like, well, the idea of being, again, like, white passing. So, I don't know. Looking at the experience of someone who is maybe applying for a job, and based on, again, the perspectives of the people who are on the hiring team and perceiving this individual as white passing, then the person gets the job versus somebody who could also be mixed, but they look very much, if it's a mixed Asian individual, like they look very much Asian. And so they're being, you know, like racism at play there. I don't know. There's a lot of stories. And I can't remember if I mentioned this to you last time, but I'm also working on a script. I won't share too many details about now, but it's very much about growing up mixed race, and explores a lot of the themes we've talked about today of just not feeling like you belong, and confusion around identity, and kind of living a double life. And
no, I think those are great points. And, you know, society, I don't think, like, we're gonna, the mixed, I think that's right, mixed people are the largest demographic in America. Mainly because there's like just so many people, and there's just so many different relationships that come around, and the demographics between, you know, which mixed ethnicities is probably incredible. You know, I hear new combos every day, but I think that's what makes it a kind of a cool and great
melting pot of different cultures and being able to bring both in. I see what people are doing with mixed cultures and bringing both sides in. I honestly don't bring in both sides because I think I grew up so white and then I thought I was white. So kind of like my whole Japanese American culture got erased, whitewashed by just society and, you know, historically. And so bringing that back is really important to me. And I think that makes, you know, it's another part of the storyline is bringing back culture, bringing back things that were lost, but still not totally fitting in or fitting with the same community that you're supposed to be a part of, but then also fitting in. It's weird. It's weird things. And I think that's more stories that can be told that way. And with both parents would be great. Because I feel like I watch so many movies and shows where the one parent's missing. You know, I feel like...
That's so true.
Yeah. You know, right. To all the boys I loved before, she was mixed with a white dad. Pen 15, his Japanese grandmother, white dad, dad's out of the picture. You know, there is that part of the representation that just goes missing is like having both parents in the mix and seeing different sides, different points of views. Because I think that's just a whole part of it. I don't agree with my mom all the time. I still love her a lot, but we don't agree on a lot of politics. And then she doesn't see me, you know, she doesn't see me as Asian. Right, she's me as her child. So when I tell her, "Oh, this white man gave me the KKK symbol," and she goes, "Oh no, isn't you just doing it's an okay thing, right?" I'm like, "No, it's not."
Wow, that's no. You make a really that's a really excellent point about only one parent being represented in so much of television and film, and then what you were just saying about your mom too. Like, I had a conversation with my mom last year where, you know, with everything happening with Black Lives Matters and anti-Asian hate and just everything, and she very much said just like, I don't see you guys as, you're just my children. And I was like, okay, but mom, you understand why it's important to like acknowledge, you know? And so just even your mom saying too, like, you're just my son,
right? Mm-hmm.
It's again interesting, like these are, you know, conversations that can be uncomfortable but necessary to have, I think.
Yeah, well, growing up in like the 90s, it was that whole colorblind culture. It's like, I don't see color. I only see one race, the human race. I'm like, yeah, we all see color. We all see color very clearly. You just want to try to ignore it. So don't ignore it. Go into it a little more and see what that difference is. And so, and I think within mixed families, it's a whole different thing. I'm more Asian passing than my sister. Right. And so that brings a whole different thing. And being Asian male, it makes a whole another difference. And so we all have different, very, very different views of Asian America in my family, in my immediate family. I think I only totally agree with my grandmother. My grandmother and I see eye to eye. My Japanese grandmother.
Okay.
She does not see eye to eye, doesn't get it. And so, but she's got every one of her kids is mixed, is not married to white for the most part.
Right.
So it's like, well, you know, it's that whole conversation of race in a white family when that's historically just been very different. And so, yeah, a lot of conversations about this topic needs to get discussed. But is there anything you'd like to add as we kind of wrap it up?
I mean, discussed a lot, and this has been so great. I think, again, I just reiterating your point, actually, about what you were saying, of in order to really have that authentic representation on screen for people of color and people of mixed race, we do have to start with, who's behind the scenes. And so that does, it's hopefully seeing more people of color and of mixed race in the writers' rooms and like you said, casting directors and agents. And because it made me so happy what you were saying about this modeling agent that you're meeting with, because it's so true what a difference it can make in interacting with somebody who just gets where you're coming from. I just have experience recently, I'm looking for a new therapist, and I almost set up a session with this particular woman, and come to think of it, I've only ever had like white women as therapists in the past, and this is a white woman, and I was just like, why am I hesitating to actually book this, like this initial consultation with this woman? I was like, it's because I actually want to seek out someone of color. They don't need to be Asian, but somebody who would be able to just, I think, hold space differently. Based on, you might have some kind of similar language to speak. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, you don't have to explain. You don't have to teach them, right? You don't have to teach them, this is my experience as a person of color. I think that's a huge difference thing too. Like even for me, I'm so hesitant to find a therapist. I do get a lot of white women. Sometimes I get women of color. Mm-hmm. I need an Asian man.
Yeah.
You're talking about Asian male things. It's a very specific topic that I can't even talk to black men about because they don't get it.
Yeah.
And so I think that even, again, representation, you know, I hate the phrase, representation matters, but like that, it's just because it's really overused. Yeah. But that's the thing, right? When you start to see yourself in the other person, they see you in themselves too. So they can understand a little bit more and even just a baseline part of it, instead of having to, you know, spend half your session explaining what happens as an Asian woman or even a mixed woman. And then there's half your session, they learn something instead of you, right? They should be paying you. And so I think there's that half of it. So,
yeah,
you know, there's always room to learn, but at the same time, you know, lived experiences is much different than being taught an experience.
Yeah.
Yeah. So managers, I've heard managers say, no, I'm not going to put you out for this role. But I'm Filipina. They ask for a Filipina woman. Is the lead. It's like, no. I'm like, whoa. Why wouldn't you do that? Or even say open ethnicity. And like, no, I'm not going to put you out. It's like, well, why wouldn't you? Because you have a different client who might fit the role better? No. Yeah. That's,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I think there's that big difference. And I've heard managers, even both writing and talent, just say, oh, as in Asians are afterthought. They said, you know, we talked about diversity. And they're like, oh, we have to talk about the Asians now too? I'm like, It's just an afterthought. So I think thinking about it, and that's hard too. So you're just finding either a really good agent, really good manager who understands very well. I'm very thankful for my writing manager because he will ask the right questions, but it's also very hard. I think we also just need general representation in representation, but that's the business side. It's not the fun. It's not the fun, glamorous side. People think that's what I'm going to go to college for, to be a manager, to help somebody else. But I think we need that. I think whenever we can help each other out, find people and do that, that makes a lot of sense because we know somebody who we can trust to be thoughtful. I think that makes a difference.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah,
this was
wonderful. Well, Genevieve, yeah, thank you so much for re-upping this conversation. This is a little change. The podcast very differently, but I love it. Yeah, thank you. Anything, any last pieces of advice or something like to share?
I just, again, just adding to what we've said already, just, yeah, keep these conversations are open. So just keep having them. And yeah, I think we all can make like a little bit of difference. I feel like a lot of people don't think they can, but again, just know that you can. So whether it's having a conversation about these topics or as an actor or I guess just anyone in the industry, just like taking some kind of responsibility for how people, anybody is being represented on screen. I think we all have a duty.
Yeah. I like that. Well, Genevieve, thank you so much for spending time with us and sharing your story. I think this was a really valuable interview for me. So
thank you. I had so much fun talking.
Great. So where can people find you in your socials? You got on Instagram and stuff. Please tell us where people can follow your work.
Yeah, I'm mostly on Instagram. My handle is @GenevieveKenji. Yeah, that's the, I have a Twitter account, but I don't know how to use Twitter.
I don't understand it.
So just find me on Instagram. That's where I post most of my stuff.
Fabulous. All right. Well, thank you again so much. I can't wait for people to hear us. And yeah, I'm really excited to meet you. Thank you.
Thanks so much.